Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Conology, the podcast that idolizes one of the world's greatest anime filmmakers, Satoshi Kon. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I've pivoted my career in a direction I don't fully understand.
So join us on our quest into the world of Satoshi Kon.
Welcome back to the Ghibliotech, or what once was the Ghibliotech. This is now the Conology. And Michael, I need to know what on earth I've stepped into here, and why are we doing this?
Well, we've talked for quite a while about broadening out beyond Ghibli, and listeners over the last couple of years have sent in emails or tweeted at us with suggestions. And we thought that if we ever did do any episodes that weren't about Ghibli films, we'd want to look at films or a filmmaker who had that same quality that Studio Ghibli has, some sense of a unified style or worldview or a clear canon of work that we could dig into. And Satoshi Kon is exactly that. His filmmaking career has a very specific shape, start point and end point. I mean, due to the very unfortunate fact that he died in 2010, 10 years ago, but he made four features and one TV series, and in every way, in very differing ways, each one of them is fantastic. They build on each other, they complement each other, but they're their own unique masterworks. However, it's quite a thing to throw you a curveball 20 odd films in, isn't it, Jake, to go in a completely different direction, completely different filmmaker. So we've had to bring in a ringer for this mini series. So we're bringing in producer Steph Watts to sit at the table with us and discuss these films. Steph.
Yeah, I've been kind of diving into Satoshi Kon's filmography in the past year or so. So this feels like a really fun chance to talk about some of his work. He's fast become one of my favourite filmmakers to watch. So yeah, this is going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. It's also going to be quite different. These are not Ghibli films. They're not family friendly. They're quite disturbing at times, very complex. And that's why maybe having an extra voice will be really useful, because we need to figure out what some of these films even mean first. So listeners, be warned, if you're coming off the back of Ponyo and Totoro, this is a whole different kettle of fish.
And you might want to go away and watch Perfect Blue before you listen to the rest of the podcast, because there are a lot of spoilers and we will be discussing them.
Okay, so Steph, this is a film that you're a big fan of. I've just watched it for the first time. Very fresh in the mind, and I absolutely understand everything that happened in it. The plot is very clear and concise, and I've really nailed what this film is, I think. But I think perhaps it might be helpful if you give us a quick synopsis about what actually happened in it.
Absolutely. Mima leaves her life as a pop idol behind to become an actress on a crime drama show called Double Bind. When offered a lead role in the show as a rape victim, Mima accepts, despite reservations from her manager. However, the backlash from fans over her career change and a strange website called Mima's Room, written by a fake Mima, begin to worry her. When a stalker appears and people involved in Double Bind begin turning up dead, Mima is thrown into a state of confusion, madness, and paranoia.
Okay, Right. It weirdly feels like the first day of school again, Michael. I haven't had this for a couple of years now, back on episode one of Spirited Away, where you literally had to give me the start of the history of Studio Ghibli. And you spent, what, the best part of 35 episodes gradually explaining that to me. And we've got to do it all over again. Who is Satoshi Kon?
That is a huge question, Jake. Of course, stylistically, and who Satoshi Kon is through his films, we'll find out across these episodes. That's what's so exciting about starting afresh with a new filmmaker. But this is going to be a big introductory context, if I may use that pun. So please strap in. This is going to be quite a long one. I'm really indebted throughout this whole series to a particular writer who I think has written the only monograph on Satoshi Kon's work, and that's Andrew Osmond. Unfortunately, his book on Kon is currently out of print, but all of his work is fantastic. He's got a book on Spirited Away, which has just been republished. I'd recommend checking that one out. But Satoshi Kon, born in 1963, so to put that in context, he's about 3 years older than Goro Miyazaki, so definitely the next generation along from the sorts of filmmakers we talk about usually on Ghibliotech. He grew up in Sapporo, Hokkaido, up in the north of Japan, and growing up he wanted to be an animator. He was influenced by popular series of the day, such as Heidi Girl of the Alps and Future Boy Conan, both from our good old friends Isao Takahata
from
and
the lads.
Miyazaki.
Yes.
Exactly. But he also likes a lot more overtly otaku-y, nerdy series like Mobile Suit Gundam and Space Battleship Yamato. But as a reader, he read a lot of manga and had a very varied diet. He read a lot of shoujo manga pitched at girls. So to put that in context, Whisper of the Heart, the Ghibli film, was based on a girls' manga, a shoujo manga. And he also read, in the 80s, as he was growing up as a teenager and into his college years, the new wave of alternative adult-oriented manga made by Katsuhiro Otomo, like Akira. And he was also inspired by live-action films, foreign language films. He loves Terry Gilliam, for example. So he's a real melting pot of inspirations and influences. He studied art at Musashino University in Tokyo. And while studying there, he started drawing his own manga. While we're going through his career, it sounds like he's quite a careerist guy, bouncing from one medium to the other. But I'd love to read out this quote from Andrew's book, just that it sort of gets a sense of Satoshi Kon's self-deprecating way of talking about himself. So this is a direct quote here. "I don't have much aspiration, strong desire or passion. I vaguely wanted to make my living by drawing, so I chose to go to art college. I like manga, so I drew some, which got me an award, so I thought being a manga artist was okay." So while he was still a student, he drew some sort of indie manga and won an award. And the award was presented to him by Katsuhiro Otomo of Akira fame. And that forges a relationship that would see him through for another decade or more. In fact, one of his first jobs in anime was as an art assistant on the film version of Akira. And then he would go on then to work on the film after Akira that Otomo wrote and produced called Rōjin Z. That puts him on a track into anime, and he worked on the early 90s series of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. I know that's had a recent resurgence. I know Steph's a fan of that, but he worked on the early 90s version. He also designed backgrounds and layouts for Pat Labor 2, directed by Mamoru Oshii of Ghost in the Shell fame. So even though Kon doesn't come to anime in a Ghibli way, working with the Miyazakis and Takahatas, he instead works with these big men of sci-fi adult anime, Mamoru Oshii, Katsuhiro Otomo. In fact, he all the way through this, he was also still drawing manga, much of which has actually finally made it out into English through a few collections out there. He worked on what... One of these collections that's finally been published in English was a series called Seraphim that he did with Oshii. He also worked on a series called Opus, which has been published by Dark Horse in English, that was left unfinished because he was drawing that right up until the point that he became fully fledged anime director and left it behind. But that series, Opus, I think has so many of the kernels that would then grow into what his style would be as a filmmaker. It's very metatextual. it has a manga artist being sucked into his manga and having to deal with some of the tropes and shortcuts and cliches of the storytelling that he's put into his manga when his characters start talking back at him. It's really great, but if you do go away and read it, which I would recommend, be prepared for the fact that it just doesn't finish. So he's developing his voice in manga. Let's bounce back to anime for a second, where he's working his way up the ranks. His last stop before taking on a full project as director was a short in the anthology movie Memories in 1995, which was produced and overseen by Katsuhiro Otomo. Kon wrote and storyboarded the opening short in that film called Magnetic Rose, which is very much the standout part of the film, and it's just fantastic. We should probably talk about it someday once we've talked about his actual films. Now, Perfect Blue. This is an adaptation of a novel by a guy called Yoshikazu Takeuchi, who was shopping the idea around town of adapting his novel into a film, a live-action film. Apparently they were very close to getting it made, but there was an earthquake in Kobe in 1995 that put the brakes on that, and they thought, oh, instead of it being live-action, why don't we pursue it being an animated film? And they approached the animation production company Madhouse, who in the anime world are very well known for various series over the years. Reportedly, Takeuchi goes to Katsuhiro Otomo, who illustrated some of his novels, saying, would you like to work on this, or do you know who could work on this? And Otomo says, I know just the guy who can adapt this, Satoshi Kon. And so he plucks Satoshi Kon out from the backstage of anime, making his backgrounds and storyboards and writing, and says, you are going to direct this. So Kon was up for it, although he said to Madhouse that he'll only take on the project if he could completely rewrite it with his co-writer, Sadayuki Murai. And apparently he was allowed to do that as long as he kept three concepts from the original novel, which is it had to have a pop idol in it, it had to have horror, and it had to have a stalker of some kind. But then everything else could be however they've envisioned it. Now, this may be a familiar story to people who've been listening to the podcast for a while. This was initially going to be a straight-to-video low-budget film, and they planned it that way. However, they then bumped it up to being a full-fledged theatrical feature, at which point, because of the change in production values between straight-to-video and cinema animation techniques, Kon had to cut the script down, the storyboards that he'd done. So he apparently cut out 100 scenes from the storyboard. And he actually reveled at that chance because it actually inspired him to experiment with his storytelling techniques. All these sort of like jump cuts and overlapping scenes and flashbacks and flash forwards. And weirdly, because of that crisis of opportunity, that informs his films going forward and becomes actually quite an important part of his style. That's Perfect Blue. And Perfect Blue premiered at the Fantasia Film Festival in Canada, which starts off a relationship between the festival and the filmmaker that would see them through for the next few films. And get this, it was the only Satoshi Kon film to get a UK release, a very limited one in both London and Edinburgh, but it then came out on video straight after, released by Manga UK at just the right time where there was that boom in sort of cult horror anime video in the late 90s. So it developed a bit of a cult following. And it didn't go unrecognized or unnoticed in the States either. It had a building reputation and was optioned to be remade in the States by Darren Aronofsky. This is a story very often told about Perfect Blue. Darren Aronofsky very inspired by it, influenced by it, and then inserts a couple of hat tips and homages and shots into his films that are definitely ripping off or inspired by Perfect Blue. There's one specific shot in Requiem for a Dream, and I think a lot of Black Swan, his psychological horror, is based on Perfect Blue, just in a different setting. Ballet dancing rather than pop idols in Japan. But that's it. I can take a breath now. That's taken us Kon from birth to blue.
But something that we've mentioned before on the show, Michael, was that you first watched Princess Mononoke in a double bill with the first Harry Potter, and that cemented your love of Ghibli. Do you remember the first time that you watched a Satoshi Kon film?
Oh, I can't pinpoint the first time. I think I would have heard about it by reputation because it was butting up against what was seen in the UK as the Asia Extreme boom, where you had Ring and Dark Water, etc., coming out and being marketed in a specific way. And you did have the harder end of anime from Manga UK being positioned in a similar way. And I definitely knew about it back then. And I was also a really big Darren Aronofsky fan when I was a teenager, particularly his first two films, Pi and Requiem for a Dream. And that connection turned me on to Con. Steph, do you know when you first watched Perfect Blue? Was this the first one you saw, or did you come back to it after another Con film?
Yeah, this was the first one I saw. I think the first time I saw it was at the cinema, which is a fantastic way to see it for the first time. And my partner, Campbell, had seen it on DVD and was like, you need to watch this film, kind of dragged me to the cinema to see it. And I didn't really know anything that was about to come either, which I feel like is a fantastic way to watch this film for the first time, not knowing what it's about, what's going to happen.
And very handily, that's the exact situation we put Jake in. So we're going to have to see what you made of it, Jake.
Let's do it.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, Jake, you've now watched 20, 25 films from Studio Ghibli, and this is quite a different turn. Was there anything that you kind of first off noticed that was different from the Ghibli films in Perfect Blue?
Tell you what, guys, it's not a Studio Ghibli film, is it? I don't know what you're doing to me here. I mean, we started this out in a land of like lovely dragons and forest creatures and soot sprites and beautiful meals. And now it's a world of young women getting exploited in the entertainment industry, like the blossoming internet fandoms and the awfulness of them, and just general grimness and psychological deconstruction. Tell you what, though, it's very good. Very, very good. Loved it. Absolutely loved this film. And I mean, yeah, I had a quick look at the original review from Empire by Kim Newman of this film. And with so many first features from any director that comes onto the scene, the phrase one to watch is used a lot, and rarely does that phrase actually pay off. And I haven't seen any of the other films yet, but I think this is one of those instances in which the phrase one to watch is maybe allowed to be used.
Jake, at what point did you realise you weren't in Kansas anymore?
Well, I almost had a bit of like whiplash of that feeling, because I thought that I had it when the film started, when it opens with these kind of Gundam, Power Ranger-esque robot fighters in the very first moments. And I thought, okay, right, it's that kind of anime. This is like the anime that I've been shielded from. And then within a minute, it pulls out of that. And actually, we're in very much a real world situation. So I've had two types of anime thrown at me within 2 minutes, neither of which I've fully been allowed to explore. And then from that, the film gradually kind of keeps peeling back layer upon layer of itself and falling deeper and deeper in love with it. I thought it was magnificent, but there's just so much, and amazingly it's all crammed into 83 minutes. And looking ahead at the run times of the other films of his, not that we judge a film on how long it is, but I mean, he's cramming huge amounts in there. And I love that idea of having to lose 100 scenes of storyboards into the story and fit it all in here, because the way that all of the scenes overlap is incredible. And you mentioned how much he's inspired by live action. That's one of the things that really popped out at me, is how much this film uses things that we might recognize as live action techniques and live action editing to really develop on the story and develop on the themes of it. And it's fascinating to think that that wasn't there in the foundations of it.
Yeah, I think especially as well when you're coming from watching Ghibli, especially Miyazaki, where we've kind of gone over the fact of him starting a story and then kind of just throwing away the storyboard and just doing whatever he feels like. This feels so structured, and you can see like every single shot and edit has been thought about, and thinking about how that actually structures the story. Because I mean, once we get properly into that confusion and Mima being confused about what's going on, you need that more than ever, so that it doesn't kind of fall apart.
And these techniques, just to expand on that, it's things that you would think of as being like very planned out on a live action set, like match cuts for the beginning and ending of a scene and the overlapping of dialogue from one scene into another. But because this is about someone's identity gradually splitting in some ways, by doing those amazing overlaps and by almost feeling like it's one continuous journey and really trying to hide the joins between any of the scenes, it becomes so fluid. And what could be a real mess, because it's throwing so many things at you, because it is so fluidly made, you can descend into it really easily.
It's in Andrew's book that he says that Khan and his co-screenwriter would write these drafts and then probably spend 5 or 6 hours just figuring out what the drafts meant, because they'd be going off in such different directions, peeling away the layers of identity and psychology and making it really messed up. But before we get deep into that stuff, I quite like to talk about the almost the superficial layer of this. The animation style is very different to Ghibli, certainly with the approach to character design. With Ghibli, particularly Miyazaki or the Miyazaki-influenced movies, there's a particular sort of figurative, cartoony, idealized style to his characters, whereas Khan's are a bit more realistic, sometimes even grotesque in their realistic caricaturing of actual people. And it can make it seem ugly compared to Ghibli. Was that something that you felt, Jake?
Well, I wouldn't say it was ugly. I think that like, there are moments in the film that are very maybe impressive is the word rather than beautiful in any way. And it's going for a reality, but it's a grungier reality. We've briefly mentioned films like Your Name and Weathering with You from Shinkai, and those films are based in a reality, a hyper reality, and it's so glossy and lovely, and it's trying to make the real world look beautiful as it is. And this is not that same real world. But I still found it appealing. Maybe that's just me being nostalgic for being in Japan. But I can kind of see the the manga artist in it, because it doesn't have the sprawl that you might get in a Ghibli film, where we talk about those never-ending landscapes or anything. Every frame feels like you could almost see the boxes of a comic around it. And yeah. And that felt different to me. And
okay.
The way that the faces are used, people might almost, although there isn't a camera, look directly into it. And you feel like faces really filling up the frame and being a quite interrogative force in it.
It's going to be a recurring theme throughout this, because a few of his films and then the TV series Paranoia Agents are all set in Tokyo or specific districts of Tokyo. And as a guy who grew up in the in North Japan, who came down to Tokyo for university, I think Kon always, you know, looked at Tokyo for inspiration. I love that we do still have train scenes. We still have nighttime landscapes, looking out of a window, seeing the blinking lights and so on, that we may recognize from certain films that we remarked on in the past. But I like, Jake, where you say that it's quite boxed in, because that allows another thing I love about Satoshi Kon's work to really come to fruition, which is his hyper-detailed production design and Mima's actual flat that she goes to. We've seen her live the pop idol lifestyle. She's done this farewell concert, and it's flashing back and forth, almost like Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now's, you know, famous sex scene, where you're seeing the post-coital and pre-coital at the same time. You're seeing the concert experience and the glamour of that at the same time as her going home on the train, going to the supermarket, and going into her dingy little one-bedroom flat. And that flat is just packed with detail. You can just pause the Blu-ray, really beautiful Blu-ray, by the way, and just drink in all the details. And I think we all remarked on the fact that she has a PlayStation squirreled away in the corner. We're like, what is that in this console in the corner? But the detail is astounding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what is great about it is that it's not necessarily the details that we have spoken about on previous films, where it's saying, oh, you need all of these details so that you can feel like you can travel into this world. This, we can imagine that room, but it doesn't necessarily invite us into it. I think the film always keeps us always at an arm's length to it. And that's very much in tune to this idea of everyone always kind of looking at Mima, and that she is always the object of something or someone. And the way that those bedroom shots are framed are more like we have a camera on her than we are there with her.
And this is a bit flippant of me, I realize, but I love how Hayao Miyazaki's view of animation is to use the power of animation and imagination behind it as the engine to create these amazing worlds, moving castles, enchanted bathhouses, etc. And what Satoshi Kon does with animation is recreate an Apple Mac desktop in uncanny detail as she's installing the internet in her flat, which, looking back now, is quite funny, really. Quite cute that circa 1997, having a web page, having the internet was something that was a bit cute and unique and strange.
Oh, yeah. I love having the line, "This is the World Wide Web."
But it just, I think, highlights for me how maybe Satoshi Kon was at the beginning of the internet, but he completely, almost as a futurologist, could see where that was going. Because this film could be so contemporary to today, to the way that stardom, the all-access social media we have, the OnlyFans cam girls of the world, it's all there within this film, as well as its look at fandom and the way that fans want to own or possess while they obsess over their fan objects.
Yeah, I think he really captures that realization that kind of Mima's computer is a bit of a two-way screen in a sense, because she's looking at what's going on out there, but then the stuff that she's reading is from somebody else looking back at her. It's quite a disturbing idea.
Yeah, and it's not just that sense of projecting your identity onto the internet that has become an issue with social media addiction and what people want to present themselves as on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. There's also the sense of ownership that fans will have for their idols. And Memania, the stalker character here, is utterly obsessed with a character that Mima plays rather than the person. And as soon as the person breaks away from the idealized version that Memania has, that tears them apart. And it's kind of this feral fandom rather than it is any appreciation for the person at all and who they might really be. And that is absolutely what happens now. And it's just amazing that he was thinking that that is where the internet would go 23 years ago.
Yeah, it made me feel quite weird about how much I share online that is probably far too personal. Like when she's reading the stuff about what she buys at the shop and she's like, I always have to have cow browned milk or something like that. And it's like, I've probably just said that I love a certain type of milk on the internet. And like, why did I do that? And why would you think that sharing that with loads of strangers is normal? Like, it's funny going to a film like that where you're so ingrained in that internet culture, you're looking back at a film that's just on the brink of it and looking at how people actually respond to this sudden kind of lack of privacy that you could be exposed to.
So there's the stuff about the internet that feels like the, you could release this film now, just update the tech a bit, and it would still feel absolutely present. But the stuff about Mima's exploitation within the entertainment industry feels like it has been ripped out of the last few years as well. And I'm like, there will be countless articles already written about how Perfect Blue predicted our current era. There's no shortage of those. But to reiterate, it is amazing. And there is some rough scenes in this film, and it is hard to watch. It's not just the gore that's horrible. Like, there, it's the violent exploitation of Mima. And there is a scene when she is an actress playing a role in which she's being sexually assaulted. And it is really harsh to watch. And the manager actually leaves it, which is very much how you feel as a viewer wanting to exit from the situation. But then turns the whole scene on its head by then flashing back and forward from the discussions about whether or not to do that scene and how that would progress in the industry, and then pausing the scene and seeing that she's okay, and that her and the actor that is taking part in the scene are like checking on each other in that moment. And it's really so much of the conversation that has been had across all of entertainment for the last century and beyond about you've got to do this thing to get yourself a leg up. You've got to prove that you're able to do this thing. You've got to sit on the casting couch. And it's getting into that and doing so in a very powerful way. But Michael, you left a note in there about whether or not it almost goes too far on this.
I think this is what is so compelling about Satoshi Kon's films, is there's always some aspect to it where there isn't a button on the storytelling. It doesn't tie everything up. So it's something that we can look at, rewatch, discuss, and dig into further. And around those key scenes of exploitation, there is when she's coerced into filming that scene in the series where they say, oh, you know, we could pump up your role in this series, make it recurring if we can have a rape scene. But then there's also the exploitative photo shoot she does, where it's with a notorious photographer who's known for trying to get young women to strip off for him. And I think what's so fascinating about this film is that it presents this interlocking web of violence, coercion, and complicity. where you're never really sure what the actual reality of the situation is, because you're seeing it in the idealized way, the nightmare way. You're seeing it from her perspective and other people's perspectives. There's no objective perspective of what happens.
And it's that arm's length again of that if we see something through a lens in some way, and that there is some element of fakeness about it, that means it's okay for us to consume it.
And with the photo shoot in particular, you're shown the same sequence twice over, and you're not sure which one was the real one. You know, was, and also we're never really clear how much agency she has as a person. She has her manager and her handler and her fans, and we see the violence through their perspectives. So the violence wrought upon Mima the pop idol is what we're seeing when that sexual assault is happening. The persona of the pop idol is being tarnished in some way. Same with the photo shoot. But we don't really get to the heart of what she thinks. Is she complicit? She's actually excelling in the performance at the moment in the sexual assault scene, and for the rest of the film as well. And at the end, there's a glint in her eye when she survives and comes out the other end. So it's always tricksy. It's always keeping you guessing. And then with the editing and the way that the film's flowing, as you said, Jake, you're already onto the next scene. I don't know, Steph, what do you make of all this?
It's a lot. It's a lot to digest. I do think it's kind of, that thing of you're getting Mima's impression of herself and her career, her kind of saying, I need to do this rape scene because it's going to help accelerate my career as an actress. It's going to help me be taken seriously. And then on the other side, you've got the kind of directors, producers, etc. And all they have to say about it is, oh, pop idols make a nice scene. So it's kind of who does she see herself as, and who do the people that are supposedly like accelerating her career, who do they see her as? And I think that scene is, even though it's kind of set up saying this isn't real, it's just a TV scene, and you have these other nods to that as well. So when they're introducing the TV show Double Bind, they have the two detectives kind of laughing and joking before the camera rolls, and then when they yell action, they kind of go into this really, the murderer peeled off the victim's skin, or like that kind of really horrific dialogue about really violent murder. So you're kind of set up to know that the scene they're filming isn't real, but in the moment it feels so real, and you see kind of Rumi and her manager really upset by it, because in that kind of moment it is really difficult to separate from that fact. And I think I guess if it was being filmed today, they would have I can't remember what they're called, like a sex consultant or something on set.
Intimacy consultant.
Intimacy consultant, yeah. It's a really interesting scene, and in some ways, to me, more powerful and interesting than a kind of rape revenge scene or something like that, where it doesn't just feel like it's there to shock. It feels like it has a specific need to be there. Mm-hmm. That scene when she decides to do the scene, and the scene with the photographer, is where her identity starts splitting, and she gets these phantom images of pop idol Mima appearing to her and saying kind of, I'm the real Mima, you're a filthy woman now, you're not real. And it's really interesting to see that her deciding to go down this certain path is splitting her identity, and kind of she's being haunted by this safely kind of titillating figure that she was, compared to the exploitation route that she's going down, and the two ways that she could have had it, I guess.
So this is what is so compelling about this film, and why rewatching it keeps in some ways knotting the mystery, but as well as loosening it slightly. Usually one person is losing their mind, and that's revealed at the end, and then you can rewatch it from their fraying perspective all the way through. In this film, three people go mad. You have Mima at the heart of it. You have Rumi and Mimania. And in various ways, they're all setting each other off. And so the rape scene and the photo shoot are both actually, could they be more traumatic experiences to the fans, to Rumi and to Mimania, than necessarily to Mima? And is Mima losing her mind because of the stalking, because of the gaslighting of Rumi going on? And that's what's really fascinating about it, because you find it hard to situate yourself into who is, what are you being horrified by and who's being the victim of the psychological horror.
It's so elegantly done, the flipping between these, that you don't even really notice. You never think, oh, I am in this person's point of view. You are never given a sign to say, this is reality, this is filmed reality, this is someone's imagination. Nothing is signposted. And it's all through that amazing construction that would have gone all the way back to those storyboards about how can we link these images together so that we can lock people in. Like the use of mirrors is something that is so well done in here. And that's something that we would so associate again with live action. Like mirror trickery is something that goes back to the birth of cinema and how you can use reflections to mess around and do early special effects. And I think maybe that's part of the reason that we get so invested in this story, because of those techniques that become associated with live action. And then you apply that to animation. And then you're thinking, right, I'm seeing animated characters, but the techniques that are being used are ones that I'm used to associating with when I can see real people. And again, we're getting into those twisted realities that the film is so good at. And again, all of that fracturing of these different identities, and it splinters off in so many different directions, but always feels connected into one hybrid mind, which I imagine is Satoshi Kon's, I suppose.
I think they also, do they film two separate endings to the Double Bind show? So they have one scene, it's like a scene back to back where they have Mima ending the show with, that's right, I'm an actress. And then another one with her saying, that's right, I'm a model. So it's like they're even, I don't think they've decided how the show is going to end either. So it's like you have these, layers on layers of what is the reality.
That's one where, you see the scene play through twice where the character's being called Mima or being called the character's name. And you're not sure whether the sleazy writer of Double Bind has started writing her in. This is something that I read it in Jonathan Clements and Helen McCarthy's Encyclopedia of Anime, and it's something I've not really seen written about anywhere else really, or many other places. In the Japanese, she has an accent that slips as she goes through, so even Mima isn't really her actual persona. It's something she's been trained up for. She's a girl from the sticks who came to Tokyo and has been trained to have a sort of received pronunciation Tokyo dialect accent. And there's a point early on where she's on the phone to her parents and her accent slips. And then the final line where she's finally, free of all of these burdens and horrors that are being visited upon her, she goes, yeah, that's right, it's me. She delivers that in her natural dialect or accent, which is something that's completely lost in English on subtitles and an English dub as well, but adds another twist to what is a really, for something that's such a dark film, it ends on a complete, like, it really sticks that landing so well.
The ending is brilliant, and we've spoken before about how Studio Ghibli occasionally doesn't know how to do a quick ending, that it will try to just wrap things up in 30 seconds and get out of there, and that this manages to do that and give you something that is jarring but perfect and manages to feel like you're solving the mystery whilst also elongating it even further at the same time. It ends so well. But Michael, we've mentioned like so many things that we think are so forward thinking that this could happen now. Is there any misgivings that you've got?
Yeah, every time I watch this film, and when I rewatched it for this, I wanted to double check I still felt this way. There are things about it that do make me feel icky. And of course, all great horror thriller films are meant to make you feel uncomfortable and ill at ease. But sometimes there are things that are just out of step. And one part of that for me for this film is Rumi-chan. Rumi, her manager or her agent or her agent's assistant. When she turns evil and is revealed to be the puppet mistress behind the strings of the idealized pop idol of Mima that's been haunting her all the way through the film, it it really plays up the fact that Rumi's a failed pop idol who's become old and overweight. And in the, I think Khan, particularly in this film and some others we may get to, leans into the caricature a bit too much in his animation style and character designs. And this one, when she's being pursued through the streets, it's actually a really elegant and beautiful sequence where you have the pop idol version of evil Mima sort of pirouetting and pogoing along perfectly from rooftop to rooftop and down alleyways. And then in reflections in windows and mirrors and advertising billboards, you see the sweaty, panting Rumi dressed in a far too small for her idol's outfit following her. And I think that's the sort of thing that now is just tipping over into being fat phobic, and this is the one character seen of that body type in this film, and it's being used against her as a marker of difference, a marker of otherness. And in fact, if you want to go so far as to look at the optics of that final shot, of the fact that she wants so much to go into to catch Mima, she's pushing herself, using her weight as a way of killing herself by pushing herself into the glass. It all just comes across as a bit too icky for me, really. I don't know. Does that resonate for you guys?
Yeah, and also with Me Mania as well, that the stalker who's definitely presented to in a kind of deformed fashion and othered throughout the film compared to all of the other online type guys that also browse the comics too, who are not presented in such a way. And actually, I think it's a more interesting character if he is just another one of the guys, because that is the scary thing about the internet, is that you can't see what people look like. And it could just be, if it is a normal looking person and who hasn't given this look, and if it is someone who's unassuming, then that is, I think, a scarier thing ultimately. And that's just a little area of that foreshadowing that he didn't quite have the opportunity to get into.
Yeah, I suppose it's a cheap shot in a way to have that character be so caricatured, but it's all in service of him being a bit of a red herring or a false villain anyway. There's somebody else behind him. But I think we will see, even from just the next film onwards, Khan's characterization and depth and elegance with how he treats his characters just improves immeasurably.
Yeah, I think if Me Mania was the kind of the only antagonist in the film, it would definitely feel far too lazy. But I think thankfully he's not the only kind of threat to Mima. And I think, yeah, like watching it a couple of times now, Rumi feels really tragic to me. Like the first time I watched it, I was like, yeah, kind of really against her in the end. But then watching it over and over again, it's kind of, she's kind of everything that the pop idol industry doesn't want from her. Like, she doesn't have Mima's body. Like, she's obviously aged a bit and is, I guess, trying to stop Mima from turning into her or kind of having a similar experience to her in such a harsh industry. And I think that she has so many kind of, in that final fight chase scene between them, so many grotesque images, but using her body, like that kind of bit when Mima is choking her to get her off of her, and her face kind of distorts out of the Mima mask into Rumi's face. It's, yeah, I feel a bit sorry for her. I know she's like the villain, but there's so many kind of layers behind her character, I think.
I think maybe this is something I'll get from future rewatches of the film, but that was an area that I found underdeveloped. And so I didn't get a sense of kind of payoff as much from Rumi's arrival in that final act. And if maybe being aware of it now, paying closer attention to the development of the story in the first hour or so, that will have more of an impact on me. But I have to say, it kind of left me wanting in the end in that area of the plot.
But Jake, did Perfect Blue leave you wanting for more Khan? I think we should find out in the final segment. But before we do, Steph, any final comments on Perfect Blue?
I would just like to say that I am a huge Sham fan, and if they were a real band, I would be following them around on their tour, buying all their music. I'm desperate to know what's in the Sham fanzine right at the start of the movie for 400 yen or whatever it is. And I love their songs. I just think they're great.
And there is Shamland, the radio show, which, I mean, if it did exist, you would 100% be hosting that.
So, Jake, this is usually the part in the podcast where we have the leaderboard and Jacob's Ladder. We can't really do that as much with this one because we're not going to have 20-odd films to rank, but I'd still like to know where these films land for you. And I've come up with a pun, as is my wont. We're going to have the popularity contest at the end of every episode. It's going to be a very easy contest for now because there's only one film, but would you give the crown to Perfect Blue?
Yes, I would have to say that Perfect Blue is currently the best Satoshi Kon film I've ever seen.
But has it made you want to watch more? Are you excited now? Or have we got you off on the wrong foot?
I'm very excited. Next week, we're going to be watching Millennium Actress, which I've been told is an inverted Perfect Blue. And I didn't think Perfect Blue could get any more inverted. It's already gone inside itself and then outside itself and around the corner and back again. And apparently we're going to invert it next week too.
I will say, Jake, I think Millennium Actress is going to be your bag. I think you're really going to enjoy it. I'm going to be really sad if you don't. So
I'm very excited.
Well, listeners, tune in next episode for our thoughts on Millennium Actress. Until then, let us know what you think about Perfect Blue or Satoshi Kon in general on Twitter at Ghibliotech. We also have our email address. The mailbag is open at ghibli@little.studios.com. And also you can follow us individually. You can follow Steph at _StephWatts.
You can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
And you can follow Michael at Michael J. Leader.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Jamie Maisner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel. Hi, listeners. Thanks for sticking through the credits. Now, after all that, you might not think there's much relationship between Perfect Blue and Studio Ghibli, but Ghibli does have its own history with pop idols becoming actors. It was made 10 years after Perfect Blue, but Howl in Howl's Moving Castle is rocking a pretty glamorous pop idol look. And he was voiced by singer Takuya Kimura, who was one of the biggest male stars of the industry at the time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.